This is Common Sense Radio. Straightforward and no excuses.
All right. Come on now.
This is the Steve Gruber Show.
Call me crazy.
Ooh, yeah.
What I said was perfectly right and spot on accurate.
Boy's got a mouth like a cannon, always shooting it all.
Stop. Yeah, stop. I mean, you're way off script.
Got it in me. Gonna quit until it all comes out.
Hey, boy.
Yeah, you know, it's not cynical, it's common sense.
Pay attention to me when I'm talking to you.
I'm gonna rock the nation.
Genuine, accountable, and raw. Here is Steve Gruber.
Six after on this Tuesday. Thanks for stopping in. The phone number here, 888-900-9966. It's the Steve Gruber Show. We appreciate your common sense, your input. We value it, in fact. Because Midwestern common sense is what this country needs today, and a lot more of it. Stop the foolishness, stop the accepting of odd behavior, and just some common sense and hard work would be appreciated. The phone number again, 888-900-9966. President Obama taking a lot of heat for admitting now, as if we didn't know this, for admitting now, he doesn't have a, quote, complete strategy in hand for training Iraqis to fight Islamic State. I mean, and why would you? It's just the JV squad anyway. So what are you worried about? But the president doesn't have a complete strategy. He doesn't have a strategy at all. It's just, I'll fill in the blank for him. Sir, you're an idiot when it comes to foreign policy. It's a bungled mess, and, a host of people, I believe, could do a better job. Both Republicans and Democrats and independents could do a better job than this bungled mess we've been witness to for the past 6 or 7 years. When a finalized plan is presented to me by the Pentagon, then I will share it with the American people. So said the president. We don't have a complete strategy yet. No kidding. House Homeland Security Committee Chair Michael McCaul said in a statement, quote, "It is no surprise this administration does not have a complete strategy for training Iraqis to fight ISIS. What is surprising is that the president admits it." Well, it's true. And let's be honest, no strategy is the strategy. That's kind of the approach here in America. The approach to ISIS was to degrade and destroy. But really, the president's mission for America has been degrade and destroy. Our economy is in the worst place it's been ever, frankly, in the modern era. Check this out. In all first quarters since 1947, the real annual rate of growth of the GDP has averaged 4%. In the 7 first quarters during Barack Obama's presidency, it has declined 0.43%. Even if you take out that first quarter of 2009, and fairly we should do that, okay, we'll take that out. And look only at the first quarters of the 6 years since the recession allegedly ended, the growth rate has been 0.4% average. To call that anemic would be kind. To call that pathetic would be accurate. In the 6 years of Harry Truman's presidency, the GDP was 4.5%, Eisenhower's 3.2%, Kennedy 4.9%, Johnson 8.3%, Nixon 5.3%. Goes on and on. Even in George Bush's days, George W. Bush, that is, the average rate for growth in first quarters of his 8 years in office, we don't even give him a mulligan year, we're giving Obama one mulligan year, is 1.7%. Four times as large as what we have currently. So it would appear that the president lacks a complete strategy for, well, just about everything. For just about everything. Obama Obama, of course, took office in January 2009, the first quarter of 2009. The GDP declined at an annual rate of 5.4%. The best quarter he's ever had was 2013. It grew 2.7%. Other than that, it was down 2.1% in 2014, down 0.7% this year, down 1.5% in 2011. Real annual growth? There hasn't been any real annual growth to speak of. So you look at this admission by the president, and you say, who's really running this thing? And then you've got the Republicans, these idiots, running out into the secret room at the Capitol to look at the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We've got to push this through. We've got to get this done now. Well, what's in it? Well, we don't know. We haven't read it. What do you mean you haven't read it? Haven't we been down this path? The Trans-Pacific Partnership, the big trade deal, involving more than a dozen nations around the world, including the United States. And John Boehner hasn't even read the document. These are the same Republicans, by the way, that were yelling and screaming and carrying on like children because nobody read Obamacare. Well, gee, guys, this is a lot shorter. You could probably read this. Jeff Sessions has gone in to read it and voiced some very serious concerns about what's written there. Not one private American citizen has seen or heard what's there because we're not allowed to because they're keeping it secret. This is America. And we're talking about legislation that will affect you and I and trade and unions and employment and immigration because it will open the borders in many ways to immigrants from other nations, not just Central and South America anymore. And we're not allowed to even know what's in it. I think the president does have a complete strategy. I beg to differ. I think his strategy is very complete. And his impact has been nearly cataclysmic. For the economy is a mess. Our foreign policy is a mess. The American military is getting smaller and weaker all the time, while the threats to America seem to be just as strong or stronger all of the time. Referring to ISIS as the JV is another slap in the face. Of course, he calls ISIS ISIL. Now, why is that? You should do a little research on that one. Why does he call it the Islamic State? Of Iraq and Levant. And not Iraq and Syria. You should look that up. You should educate yourself. That'll be your little assignment for the day. So anyhow, they're saying there's no complete strategy here. No shock. Except that I think it might be a perfect complete strategy for this president and this administration. Degrade and destroy America. It is 14 after the hour on this Tuesday. Your phone call is certainly welcome, as I mentioned, 888-900-9966. This portion of the program brought to you by Wheat Jewelers. WheatJewelers.com, the place to find just about anything you need when it comes to jewelry statewide. If you're looking for something great that has Spartan appeal, it's WheatJewelers.com. Kevin and Archie will take care of you there. If you're looking for something for your lady, for your sweetheart, it is the place to be. WheatJewelers.com, bringing you this hour of the Steve Gruber Show.
The Steve Gruber Show, jump-starting your day with the news that matters. I was born in a crossfire
hurricane. It is 18 after on this Tuesday, the Steve Gruber Show. Well, the first cases of a highly contagious avian flu that have been spreading rapidly across the United States, wreaking havoc on poultry production in the poultry industry, confirmed now in the state of Michigan. The highly contagious H5N2 virus found in 3 young Canada geese in Sterling Heights. That happened in late May, now confirmed. And it's the second punch to Michigan wildlife in a couple of weeks. Of course, the chronic wasting disease report of deer having that disease in southern Michigan creating all sorts of effects as well. We'll start there with our next guest, Kyle Malin from MERS News, joining us. Kyle, welcome to the program, of course.
Good morning, Steve. Glad to have you back.
Always glad to have you here. All right, so let's start with for the Department of Natural Resources, two pretty rough weeks, I'd say.
Yeah, that is really tough. Chronic wasting disease and now this avian bird flu. I mean, you know, and the impact to the state isn't necessarily about the animals. I mean, obviously, it's bad to have any kind of illness that impacts animals, but it also impacts industry and agriculture in this state. And the chronic wasting disease may chase hunters away from here. And then on the bird flu, it could impact poultry production, and we're the seventh largest producer of eggs, for example, in this country. So if that flu were to get into our farms, that could have a huge impact on our farmers.
Yeah, so people that think, well, you know, the deer thing, you know, I'm not a hunter, that doesn't really affect me. Trust me, it affects you, because it all these diseases, whether it's chronic wasting disease into the deer or this avian flu into the bird population, these things have impacts, and they have impacts financially to the state as well. When you look at the hunting industry, as you mentioned, $4.5 billion annually spent here in Michigan on hunting and fishing. So you start to talk about real money.
Well, and the thing here too, and the problem being that this deer was found in kind of southern Michigan here in Meridian Township in Lansing, and that's where we really want the hunters. I mean, that's where you're seeing a lot of deer kind of going south, because these last two winters have been so hard on them. They've kind of moved south here because, you know, they're dying up in the UP. And, you know, the more they move south, the more they become a danger for drivers. You know, you can't even drive on the freeway any more than 15 miles and see a carcass on the side of the road. And if that wasn't you, that could be you.
Yeah.
So we actually want hunters down here. And if a deer has chronic wasting disease, there's going to be fewer hunters who want to participate in hunting down here.
Yeah, so fewer hunters involved and money lost. Plus, these deer become, well, they call them zombies, basically, because they wander out in traffic more often. So you end up with more car deer accidents, less hunters, and it doesn't sound like a very good circle. So we'll keep an eye on that. You know, I've been seeing, in fact, Congressman Dan, I'm shifting gears now, Congressman Kildee was here on the program, oh, I guess a week ago,
mm-hmm.
As he continues his push. And I give him credit. He and I don't agree on a lot of things, as you can imagine. But we do agree on Amir Hekmati being held in Iran and that should come to an end. And I give credit to Congressman Kildee for his relentless push to keep that in the headlines.
Yeah, he was in Lansing yesterday with Jim Ananick, the State House Senate Minority Leader, talking about this issue. And I think trying to bring it in front of a different audience. You know, he's talked about it in Flint, obviously, many times. But I think he wants to bring it into a more statewide audience and let folks be aware that this is something that is going on, that Iran is holding three people, three Americans over there. And unjustly, as far as that's concerned. And so he wants to let people know, hey, as we're talking to this country here about nuclear power, this is a country that has three of our people over there who are being held for crimes that in which they did not get fair hearings, they didn't get fair representation, they didn't get you know, a fair shake on what's going on. In Amir Hekmati's case, his sister was telling the media yesterday that the Iran embassy signed off on him going over to Iran to visit his maternal grandmother. They said it was okay. They said, yeah, sure, come on over, you can go visit your grandmother. And then he gets there and they arrest him as being a spy, you know. And so that's, you know, that's obviously not fair, and obviously stinks of some type of ulterior motive by them and trying to get leverage on the United States for some kind of political reasons. And so he's trying to share this message to a larger audience, and I think that's why he was in Lansing yesterday to talk about it.
Yeah, and he's a Democrat. What's interesting with Democrat Congressman Dan Kildee is that Barack Obama's, for the most part, ignored Amir pretty much completely.
Yeah, well, you know, he says that every time he mentions it, the Amir case to President Obama and John Kerry, that they said that it's always mentioned whenever they're talking to Iranian officials, whenever they're in the same room, Amir Hekmati's name is mentioned. So he said he's got to take him at his word, but that doesn't mean that he's going to stop the push. He is not going to let that name fade away, even though, you know, it's been, you know, shoot, close to 4 years that he's being held prisoner.
Been a long time. And speaking of Congress, Dan Benishek's been the congressman up there in Michigan's 1st District for a couple of terms now. But the name being thrown around for a possible Democrat to challenge him in the next round, Lon Johnson, the chair of the Michigan Democratic Party.
Yeah, we talked about that yesterday in our newsletter. Lon Johnson has been the chair of the Democratic Party now last cycle and was just reelected here in February, but they're having problems finding, let's say, a top-tier candidate to run against Dan Benishek in an election cycle where he said that he wouldn't run again initially. When he first ran in 2010, he said he would serve three terms and be out. Well, this is his third term right now, and now he says he's going to go ahead and run for a fourth because there's some unfinished business to do. And, you know, obviously that's not uncommon for politicians to say that, but it does leave an opening for political challengers to go after them. And some of the state reps who have been mentioned as possible candidates look like they're going to be taking a pass. And the 2014 nominee, Jerry Cannon, isn't exactly known as the greatest fundraiser. And, you know, maybe the hardest worker out there. And so the Democrats are eagerly searching for somebody. And I think Lon Johnson, who lives up in Kalkaska, is saying, well, shoot, I can raise a lot of money. And, you know, he is a tireless worker. So I think he sees an opportunity, and so he's talking with people about the feasibility of that. But in this day and age, you can't be a Democratic Party chair and a congressional candidate in a competitive district at the same time.
So a choice is going to have to be made. Yeah, decision time. Kyle Malin, thank you. Very informative. Always my pleasure.
Hey, thanks.
There you have it. Kyle Malin from MERS News here filling in all sorts of gaps for you on the Steve Gruber Show on a Tuesday.
The Steve Gruber Show. Get the news and information vital to your world.
It is 33 after the hour. All right. I'll answer your question. Steve Gruber Show. The difference between ISIS and ISIL. Pretty simple. The Islamic State of Iraq and Syria is ISIS. The Islamic State of Iraq and Levant. Levant being a much larger geographical region, including Israel and Palestine, and depending on who you would discuss it with. Some would say that's because they identify that Israel and Palestine, the West Bank, and those things are there, or you're ignoring the fact that Israel has the right to exist. Now, that's something you'll have to decide for yourself. Jesus, so there you have it. Where are we? That's where you get it. The Islamic State of Iraq and Levant. You got it. It's the Steve Gruber Show on Tuesday, 888-900-9966, 888-900-9966. So if you walked into the store and put your hand under the machine, and that took your money. I mean, it's easier than Apple Pay, right? Just brush your hand by, you buy your clothes, you buy your beer, you buy your groceries, whatever, right? There it is, done. Very Orwellian, to say the least, and here, now, with these chips you can put in your hand. Catherine Albrecht is here, our next guest on the program, to discuss this in more detail. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Hey, Steve. So it's hard to believe, but we're actually living in a time when people are doing this.
Yeah.
And I think the bankers have been working on this they've been talking about this at their international conferences for 10, 20 years, but only now do we actually have the capability of actually doing it.
Well, I read a book in 1979, a long time ago, and yes, I am that old. In 1979, I read a book when I was a teenager that predicted this very event. And I've been expecting this my entire life, that you would have an ability for computers to read people, and people could therefore, because it'll be sold on safety. Well, you know, they can't steal your credit card and they can't steal your cash unless they cut your hand off. So that's not going to happen. So you're much safer. And they'll sell it to the old folks first, because the old folks that get like Social Security checks and so forth, your check can't be stolen. You're always protected. We're here to protect you. We're the government. That's how they're going to sell it. Am I wrong?
Well, I think it's going to be a little bit, hopefully, ever so slightly harder to sell it to older people, although I'm not entirely sure of that. The reason I say that is because you talk about knowing about this since 1979, but Christians, of course, have known about this for 2,000 years, because the Bible actually talks about having a number in your right hand or your forehead to buy and sell.
That's right, the mark of the beast.
Something. Can you imagine 2,000 years ago, you're living in a world that doesn't even have cars or airplanes, certainly not computers or credit cards or anything else. And there's actually a prediction in the Bible that says that there will come a time when all people will be caused to have this thing in their hand. It's called the mark of the beast, and it's something that Christians for all of history have known to resist. And so, you know, growing up in the 1970s and the 1960s, that this was a common theme. There were books and movies and people talked about it on TV. There was even a song I play on my own radio show. There was a song on the radio about this even. So people were talking about this a lot, and really it's only been in the last 10 years that we've actually, out of those 2,000 years since people have been saying, how would you buy and sell with a mark on your right hand? How would you buy and sell with a number? How would that be possible? We actually now can do it. And in fact, a couple weeks ago, there was a guy in Sweden, a businessman, who held a press conference and claims to be the first human being who has implanted bitcoins, a microchip, a little glass encapsulated microchip containing his Bitcoin number account. And he actually held a press conference and said, hey, everybody, you know, look, Ma, instead of no hands, it's look, Ma, my right hand can now make a payment by just simply waving in front of these machines.
And make no question, I mean, these sorts of chips, this sort of technology has been available to, well, I've used for veterinarians for years and years because, like, my dogs are chip implanted. In case they're ever lost, you scan my dog, bam, you know, take Rover home with this kind of technology for 20 years, right? So that's been around for a long time. This technology, I think, probably has been longer than 10 years, but so it is. It doesn't matter.
Well,
it's here now.
What we haven't had the capability of was the ability to link all these things together, because in order for you to be able to, I mean, as the Bible says, all people, great and small, rich and poor, free and imprisoned or enslaved, free or bond, literally everybody on the planet, we've not identified everybody on the planet until just the last couple of years. In fact, National Geographic recently came out and said, we think we've now contacted the last uncontacted tribe. So when I was growing up, there were all sorts of mysterious people who lived in the Amazon or the Aborigines in the Outback, and now we believe we've contacted them all. So that's new. It is new to be able to link up these numbers. So you could be in the Outback in Australia, or you could be in the Amazon, or you could be at the top of Mount Kilimanjaro, and you could actually take the number in somebody's hand, the microchip number transmitting with a radio wave, and you could make a payment with it that could be picked up in Zurich, Switzerland within minutes or even seconds using the internet.
So we didn't have
that capability up until literally just about the last 5 years. So we're living in the first time that it's been possible to do this.
So let's make it even more frightening. We're on the line with Catherine Albrecht this morning. Let's make it more frightening, Catherine. Let's do it this way. Find my iPhone, right? You can do that right now. You can find your iPhone, and you know, it can be tracked by satellite and so forth. Well, I guess you could be able to track people if you can have your iWatch, you know, your Apple Watch, that people can talk to you and communicate with, your little wrist communicator, and you dial that down to a chip that goes wherever it goes. Not only could you buy and sell and trade and do those sorts of things, you could be tracked in real time by anybody all the time, because that'll prevent crime, Catherine. We'll be able to keep crime under control. Seriously, we're going to make it a safer world. You just have to submit to our chip.
Yeah, and it's not just the microchip. It's really that we are building the surveillance apparatus to make all this possible. Because you might say, well, nobody's going to make me take a microchip to buy and sell. I'll just not participate and kind of hide out. And the reality is that we, for the last probably 20 years, since the internet era, have been really fast, working at a fast clip, an accelerated pace, to build a surveillance network. So, you know, we call this thing that circles the globe a net. We call it a web. Well, where there's a net, there's a predator and there's prey, and where there's a web, there's a spider. And we're actually using the web to build the body of the spider. And what that spider wants to be able to do is to hear every conversation, notice every place everybody goes, be able to monitor every action, every activity, every payment, every you name it. And that network is being built. And if you think about it, you drive through even small towns in America, and the intersections have cameras that are capturing your license plate and recording that they've seen you.
And everything you do.
You drive through the toll booth, and your toll transponder's recording you. You've got your GPS device. Everywhere you go, it knows where you're going. And by the way, the GPS, if you think about it, you've gone from these mainframe computers. My dad used to work at one in the 1970s. It took up two city blocks in Ohio.
Right.
And so we've gone from that to the desktop, to the laptop, to the cell phone, to the iWatch. And what is the next step? It is the implant. And in fact, these companies will be the first ones to tell you.
Well, that's where they're going with it. The question is, will the proles ever push back? Or will they just fall in love with Big Brother? That's the question.
They've made it addictive, and they've made it beautiful and fascinating. And, you know, you go to a restaurant, and half the families in there aren't even talking to each other anymore because they're staring down into the little glow of the cell phone. So how are you going to push back from something that you're so in love with, so enamored with, that you won't even put it down long enough to talk to the very people in your family that you love?
And see, I always thought Big Brother was going to be a poster on the wall, and instead he's going to be a little machine in my hand. Catherine, I have to run. Thank you for scaring the daylights out of all of us. I appreciate
that.
We'll have you back sometime soon.
Good. Thanks, Steve.
There you have it. Catherine Albrecht, everybody. The first money transfer to a microchip in somebody's hand and deposits and activity. That ought to really scare you. Privacy? What privacy? 41 after on the Steve Gruber Show.
This is the Steve Gruber Show, bringing you the news and newsmakers that affect you most.
I pulled into Nazareth, was feeling about half past dead. I just need some place where I can lay my head.
It's 45 after the hour. We've talked about a bit over the last couple of weeks, quite a bit, in fact. The Department of Natural Resources having its challenges. And then we find that the H5N2 virus, a highly contagious virus in avian populations, found in at least 3 wild geese in Sterling Heights. Not good news. And this comes on the heels of the chronic wasting disease discovery in southern Michigan and Meridian Township. Challenges on many fronts for the Department of Natural Resources for a variety of reasons. Joining us today, Steve Schmidt from the DNR, the veterinarian there. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Steve. Glad to be here.
Well, let's start with the news of this avian flu in Sterling Heights. What is it, and why should we be concerned?
Okay, well, avian flu is caused by a virus, and basically this virus circulates in wild waterfowl worldwide and has for 1,000 years. There's a lot of different subtypes, 144 different subtypes, and under those subtypes are different strains. The one that's particular about this, highly pathogenic, meaning that it will kill domestic chickens and turkeys. It doesn't really have much effect on wild birds. It certainly won't kill a lot of wild ducks or geese, but it's been found in 20 states so far, with the 21st one in either commercial poultry, backyard poultry, or in wild birds. We're the sixth state to find it in only wild birds, and that's where we hope it, you know, stays, because it's not going to be a big problem there. It's when it gets into domestic turkeys and chickens. They've over almost 50 million across the U.S. have either died or had to be euthanized because of avian influenza. It's cost the federal government over $500 million. So it's a big thing to the domestic poultry industry, not a big thing to the wild birds.
And why do you say that? Why is it not a concern to the wild birds? It's more of a concern to domestic poultry production.
Well, it's because this virus, as I said, has been in, it's adapted to the wild birds. It's always circulating. There's always avian influenza viruses in wild waterfowl worldwide. It's only when it becomes a certain strain, certain subtypes, will cause a problem for domestic poultry. And we talked about highly pathogenic. All that means, that refers to domestic chickens and turkeys. It has nothing to do with wild birds or other animals or humans. It just means that that particular strain will kill chickens and turkeys and kill them quickly in a matter of a few days large numbers.
Yeah, and obviously Michigan being the seventh largest producer of eggs, for example, in the United States, could have a devastating financial impact on the state. The other thing that we've been following, of course, the chronic wasting disease, the discovery so far of one case in Meridian Township of this deer that was put down in May, I believe, near the city of Hazlitt there in southern Michigan. And now the plan is in place. And bring us up to speed of what you can tell us about deer being tested, deer being taken for testing and so forth. Where are we? I know we're still in the early stages here of the state's plan. I think this plan was designed and put on the shelf in 2002, and we hope never to use it, but here we are.
Yeah. 2002, we wrote the plan, and then we updated it in 2012. And you're right. I've been with the DNR for over 30 7 years, and finding CWD was, that would be my worst nightmare, and we found it. Now, what we're hoping, and a couple other states, Minnesota and New York, had the same thing where they found it in a wild deer, but they did not, the disease was not established or self-sustaining in their deer herd. So they were able to navigate their way through and come out, you know, without the disease becoming established. But and that's what we're hoping here. We just found one, but you never find the only one. So there's other positive deer out here in the Hazlet area. By the way, I live here in Hazlet, about 2 miles from where that deer was found. But what we're hoping is that we don't find a lot of other infected deer, and that they're not too far from where this first positive was found. If that's the case, then there's a chance that it isn't established. And we could, by reducing deer numbers, hopefully keep it from becoming established. Once it's established, all of the other states and Canadian provinces where it's been established in the free-range deer elk herd, none of them would be able to eradicate it or control it.
No, it's in the ground, right? I mean, the pathogen itself is just different. It's not a virus. It's not a bacteria. It's a protein that once it's in the ground, it doesn't act like other pathogens that we're more familiar with. I think that's a fair way to put it.
Yeah, absolutely, Steve. Because it's this environmental contamination part where that prion, that the infectious agent, it can get into the ground and bind with soil particles and stay there active for years. And
does anybody know how long? I mean, that's been people keep asking me, how long is it in the ground? How long, doctor?
Well, they don't know exactly for sure, but some other prions, scrapie, which is a disease of sheep and goats, they documented that for at least 16 years. So I would, you know, nobody is going to say, you know, that, you know, X number of years, but it's a long time, and it might be a decade. And that's why, once it becomes established, once you get this environmental contamination to the level, you could actually snap your fingers and all the infected deer die, removed off the landscape, but you still have the landscape contaminated with the prions.
So the next round of deer are contaminated. So I guess we're very hopeful, Steve, that we get this under control, because otherwise, I mean, my farm, my small 40-acre hobby farm is only about 4 miles away. So I'm not in good shape either, my friend.
No, not at all. And, of course, you know, this is something that it's not going to wipe out all the deer. The modeling that's been done suggests that over a long period of time, it may take decades before we actually see a decline in the deer herd.
Well, that's good news. We've got to leave it there.
40, 50 years from now, we might end up having, we'll have a smaller deer herd, we'll have a younger deer herd.
All right, Steve, we've got to leave it there. Dr. Steve Schmidt from the DNR on a couple of challenges we're facing right now here in Michigan.